Welcome, everyone, to the Cup of Coffee podcast with me, your host, Tom Dillon. This has been recorded live at our weekly online meeting and broadcast around the world. Today's topic is the estate of a property entrepreneur. What should you be considering with lovely Lucy Fowler and I think a beautiful assistant as well? Before we start, I'd like to say, by way of a disclaimer, that today is a wonderful discussion, but that nothing said here constitutes financial advice. You should always take professional advice before investing your hard-earned cash. There may be the odd unplanned swear along the way as well. The format for today is that Lucy will speak to us for a while, and then we'll be taking questions from me and from the floor. Lucy is an experienced associate solicitor with the private client at JMW Solicitors, based in Manchester. She specialises in all areas of private client law, including wills, trusts, lasting power of attorney, estate administration, and estate and tax planning for business owners and property investors. Hello, Lucy.
Brilliant. Perfect. Thank you. I'm just going to share my screen, so hopefully you can all see this. Bear with me. Tell me if you can't in a minute. Can you see all that fine?
Yes. Yes, all good.
Brilliant. Perfect. Lovely. Yeah, so thanks for the introduction, Tom. So my name's Lucy. I am a solicitor at JMW. I work in the private client department, and I'll be presenting today with my colleague Taz, who is a partner and head of the private client team. So just a little bit about JMW, in case you don't know who we are. We are based in Spinning Fields, Manchester City Centre. If you know Spinning Fields, we're just near the Ivy. We also now have offices in Liverpool and London, and there's about 500 of us in total, and we advise all clients, so from private individuals right through to international companies. So JMW as a whole is a full service law firm, so we do everything from services for your business, so corporate law, commercial law, and services for individuals. So we're there at the bottom in wills and estate planning, also personal injury, family law, so we cover everything. So particularly in relation to estate planning services, so what do we do? We like to see ourselves as the friendly death lawyers. So anything in relation to death we can assist with, whether that's a will, a codicil to a will, so an addendum made to a will, trusts, family investment companies. When someone passes away, we'll deal with the probate and the administration of the estates. As private client advisors, we also advise on inheritance tax and the taxation of trusts. And we also offer a holistic approach for our clients. So we deal with accountants and financial advisors and tax specialists to advise on the other taxes which are listed there. Mental capacity, so we deal with powers of attorney. And if unfortunately somebody's already lost capacity, the court of protection route. And we do fit nicely with the other departments. So whether that's property and someone wants to put in place a declaration of trust or a family, and there is a need for a prenup, or corporate becomes involved. If there is a family investment company, we all tend to work together. So I didn't want to bore you just in relation to speaking about wills today. And I hope you've all understand the importance of a basic will, and you all have a basic will in place. I thought we'd go a little bit further than that and talk about trust wills. But just to start with, if you don't have a will, I'm sure you're all aware that your estate would pass in accordance to what's known as the intestacy rules, which is a list of people who would inherit if you pass away without a will. I think sometimes there is the presumption that between a husband and wife, everything would pass to each other if you don't have a will. And it's just to be careful that isn't actually always the case. If you have children, for instance, it's actually the first 270,000 that passes to a spouse, and then anything above that passes equally between the children and a spouse. So it's just being aware of what the intestacy rules actually say. They also don't protect partners or living cohabitants, so just being aware of that. But presuming you all hopefully understand the intestacy rules and a basic will, we thought about discussing maybe going one step further and thinking about potentially a trust and having a trust will, and why someone should have one of those wills as opposed to a basic one. And there's just some statements here that may may be of interest of why what a goodwill can actually do. So it can protect your assets for up to 125 years and save inheritance tax for ongoing generations. It can ring fence your wealth against care home fees in the future. It can protect a vulnerable beneficiary. For instance, if you have beneficiaries that are on means tested benefits and you wouldn't want an inheritance to affect that. It can protect an estate against a divorce. So you might be happy with leaving your assets to your children, but would you be happy with the wealth then passing to their potential spouse, ex-spouse, if they're going through a divorce? You can save additional inheritance tax if you are a widow. You can benefit from double dip inheritance tax relief if you own certain business assets or agricultural property assets. A goodwill can also allow you to plan for your future generations to take into account their tax positions, and it can protect your estate from the possibility of a surviving spouse remarrying in the future, potentially leaving it to the new spouse and potentially cutting out to your children. So before we go on to discuss types of trust wills, I thought we'd just have a brief mention about inheritance tax and whether you're actually familiar with what the inheritance tax rules are. As Roy Jenkins has said there, it's a voluntary levy. So inheritance tax, with the correct advice and planning in lifetime, can be an avoidable tax. So do we know what the rules are? Well, there's never any tax between a husband and wife. An individual has £325,000, which passes free the inheritance tax. Between you as a married couple, you would have £650,000. And anything above that, there is 40% tax on. There's also what's known as the residential mill rate band, which is if you have a property and your estate is worth less than 2 million and you leave that property to direct descendants, you get an additional £175,000 each. So a married couple can potentially leave an estate of up to £1 million without paying inheritance tax. There's also a few exemptions. So if you have a trading business, you can potentially get business property relief. Or if you own a farm, for instance, or land, you could potentially get agricultural property relief. So different types of wills. I thought we'll discuss these with you. And then I've just got two case studies to go through, which just show the importance of maybe thinking a little bit further than a basic will. So basic mirror wills, everything between husband and wife on first death, when you're no longer here, to your children outright. Flexible life interest wills. So what is the difference with this one? Well, instead of everything going between a husband and wife on first death, when, for instance, husband, let's kill him off first, he dies first, instead of his estate going to wife, his estate passes into a trust. And the reason why people do this is potentially, for instance, if wife was to go off and remarry, husband's estate is protected and can't be used to go to new spouse. If maybe husband's been married before and he has children and he's frightened that his wife would potentially cut out his children. Or for instance, if wife was to go into a care home, husband's estate is protected from care home fees. A discretionary trust will. With this one, you could still have everything between husband and wife outright on first death, but on second death, instead of it going to children automatically, it's protected in a trust for their benefit. And people tend to do this in order to protect their wealth. For instance, their children may be going through bankruptcy or divorce, and they want to protect their assets and ensure that they don't go, for instance, to an ex-spouse of their children. Nobody knows when you're going to pass away and what position your children will be in. So it offers an extra layer of protection. You then have business property relief and agricultural property relief trust wills. And our second case study will show the benefits of that. And then nil rate band discretionary trust will. Some people are unaware that if you've been a widow and then remarry again, you could potentially have three nil rate bands protect an estate for an inheritance tax, and that's what those will, that will does there. And finally, with any trust will, you put in place a letter of wishes, and a letter of wishes dictates to your trustees what you want to happen when you're no longer here. A letter of wishes could be amended over time. You would simply just sign it and date it, no need for a witness, and provide us with a copy. So you can easily change your instructions without having to change the body of the will over time. So there's two case studies, and I just wanted you to see the difference with having a basic will over a trust will. So with case study one, we've got Mr. and Mrs. Jones, and they're in their 80s, and they own a family home and a property investment portfolio, and their total assets are 3 million. So if they had a basic will, on first death, there would be no tax, it's everything to each other. And then on second death, when it goes to the children, they get the £650,000 tax-free allowance. Everything above that is taxed at 40%. They don't get the residential nil rate band because their estate is above 2 million. So there would be a nice inheritance tax bill there of 940,000. If instead they'd come to us and they'd done a flexible life interest will trust, this is just to show how inheritance tax can change. So Mr. Jones, we'll kill him off first. His half share of the estate passes into a trust whereby Mrs. Jones has the benefit of it. The aim of the exercise then is for Mrs. Jones to gift away the 1.5 million that's in this trust for the benefit of the next generation, so for children and grandchildren. Then when Mrs. Jones dies, presuming she survives for 7 years, there is taper relief after three, she will only have in her estate the 1.5 million, and the hope is that the 1.5 million the trust has been gifted away. You would then be able to actually offset the 1 million, you'd get the residential nil rate band because her estate's now below 2 million, and it would just leave £500,000 being taxed at 40%, which is £200,000. So you've gone from having an inheritance tax bill of 940 to having this inheritance tax bill of 200,000 for saving of 740 in tax, just from simply changing the structure of the will and having a bit of planning in lifetime. Now, case study two is Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and they own a £3 million business property trading company. So they buy land, they develop on the land, and then they sell the land. They also have a £2 million taxable estate, which could consist of cash savings, family home. Again, if they have a basic will, there'd be no tax on first death. On second death, presuming everything goes between husband and wife, on second death, before it goes to the beneficiaries, the BPR business property relief would apply to the trading company, so there's no tax. The £2 million estate less the 650 would be subject to tax of 540,000. Again, no residential nil rate band because the total estate is worth more than 2 million. Business property relief company counts as assets for the total value, even though there will be no tax on that. So what if instead we'd put a business property relief will trust in for the clients? So again, we'll kill Mr. Smith off. He dies and his 1.5 million share of the business passes into the BPR trust. His half share of the taxable estate, so 1 million passes to Mrs. Smith. And then what we're left with here is Mrs. Smith has a £2 million taxable estate. She has her own 1.5 million shares in the company, and Mr. Smith's shares are now in the trust. And what the BPR will trust allows is some quite effective inheritance tax planning in that we do a swap. So Mrs. Smith uses her 1.5 million taxable assets and swaps it for the 1.5 million shares. What then would happen on Mrs. Smith's death, presuming she survives for 2 years, is she then owns £3 million BPR assets, which there's no tax on. The 1.5 million of the taxable assets are now in the trust, so there's no tax. And all she's left with is 500,000 of the taxable assets. And because this is under the £650,000 annual the nil rate band, there's no tax liability. So we've gone from having a £540,000 inheritance tax liability to no liability. So these two cases are obviously heavily focused on inheritance tax and show how a will trust can help reduce inheritance tax. But a will trust isn't just used for inheritance tax mitigation. It can also be used for potentially care home fees or protection, as we've seen, as I discussed previously. So, importance of robust wills and LPAs. JMW offer free wills reviews service. Trusts are complex, and it is something that you need to sit down with the family and discuss. With COVID-19, we are able to do these via Zoom, but we're also meeting clients in the office. As will advisors, we are one of the exceptions, and we can actually meet clients in the office and to do those. And we're also doing signing and witnessing wills via electronic means. So for example, you can witness a will via Zoom. So there's no need for putting things on hold because of COVID-19. As I said there, periodic review is important. As life changes and you get more assets, it's important to consider whether your will is sufficient. And there's just an example there of a recent client. He had an estate of 650. He was giving his second wife 500,000 and the rest to his children. There would have been no tax on that. However, when he died, he actually owned an estate of 3 million, only giving his wife 500,000 then and the rest of children. That would have meant quite a large inheritance tax bill. We could actually do a deed of variation in that case and luckily vary the estate, but it just shows the importance of reconsidering your will, we'd say every 5 to 10 years. And then finally, a little bit of power of attorney at the bottom there. LPAs, they used to be historically thought of as being for older people. With, for instance, if you were to lose capacity because you may have dementia or you're old and frail and you need help and assistance. But COVID-19 has actually shown us that the importance of powers of attorney for younger people, and especially as business property owners. If you have potentially maybe someone you work in business with and you would fall pooling, you're in a hospital, who has continued to run that business and sign those documents on your behalf? And we've seen more people doing business LPAs in order to put something in place in case that does happen. If you're unfortunately, for instance, knocked down outside and you can no longer sign things, you've lost the capacity, it's important to get in place a property LPA and also one for health and welfare. If you don't and it's too late, you've already lost capacity, the court of protection routes can be extremely expensive and time consuming. We see them as a bit of a life policy document. You put them in place, hopefully we'll never need them, but they're there just in case. Now I'm just going to pass you over to my colleague Taz, and she's going to discuss a little bit about property lifetime tax planning for property entrepreneurs.
Thank you, Lucy, and morning everyone. My name is Taznim Khalid, most people call me Taz, and I head up the private client department at JMW. For my sins, I've been doing this panning across 2 decades, so over 15 years. And I've got personal experience in my family have extensive property portfolios, and I've been advising clients panning across 2 decades with property portfolios. We will speak to anyone, as Lucy said, on a completely no obligation basis, have a conversation with anyone. So our smallest property client might just have one rental property and nothing else, but our biggest clients probably got, is worth £1 billion in international assets and huge commercial residential properties here. So I just wanted to flag up a few case studies and issues that we're seeing nowadays about lifetime tax planning. Now, from a private client lawyer's perspective, so from our perspective, we look after the families. We're looking after your personal needs, making sure that the families essentially are well looked after. And if God forbid somebody passes away, loses mental capacity, that your loved ones are protected. But we're not naive in looking at that on an insular basis. There's lots and lots of other taxes that affect property entrepreneurs or property owners. And so we look at everything objectively and ensure that we are addressing all of the other taxes. Now, we don't personally advise on the other taxes, but we work alongside specialist accountants. And I can see Tom was talking about Champion Accountants, and we also know them, a very reputable firm. And so it's organisations like that that we work alongside to ensure that every property entrepreneur or owner is considering the other taxes. So, and don't wish to teach your grandmother how to suck eggs, but the pertinent taxes that we are mindful of when we're speaking to a property owner are when's buying a property, SDLT, and the repercussions of that. And when owning, income tax, inheritance tax, corporation tax, and when selling, capital gains tax. Now, we act for property owners across, you know, all stages of their lives. So we're sometimes on the acquisition side, where somebody's looking at growing their property portfolios, and the advice that we would give them when they're on the acquisition side. Similarly, we're acting for clients who are in their 80s, 90s, or start thinking about succession. What happens if I pass away? Now, our lovely government don't like us property owners, and they want, because they are, it's a great way of accumulating wealth, and bricks and mortar is nice, reliable wealth to have. And there, we've been penalised quite heavily over the years from these taxes creeping up. And I think it's all political from my perspective, and my small view on it all is that they're trying to free up housing stock, and so they have been penalising investors along the way. So a few years ago, some of you may recall when interest rate reliefs were dropped, etc., etc. Now, more and more of our clients are, so I've just put down there as a second bullet on this slide, about a few tax planning case studies. So a lot of our clients have come to us where the 20 years ago, they got excellent mortgage deals, ended up with big property portfolios, but they're all in their individual names, and they're now allowed to offset certain interest on mortgages in relation to their personal income. And so they want to incorporate. And what does that look like? Going from owning it in your personal name to ending up in a limited company. So we've advised clients across that. It sometimes involves bare trusts, doesn't necessarily have to remortgage the entire property portfolio. And certain tax advisors will say, if you're running it as a business, then you can transfer a property, personal property portfolio into a limited liability partnership or an ordinary partnership. And from the ordinary partnership, you can then transfer it into a limited liability company. So if I give you a personal example, if I own a personal property in my name, I am a higher rate taxpayer. I mean, lawyers don't get paid as much as half people think they do, but I am a higher rate taxpayer. And my personal property portfolio, if it's in my personal name, I've got to pay 45% income tax on. Now, if that same property is owned in a limited company that belongs to me, then limited companies are paying the rate of 19%. We appreciate the limited company rate is going up to 25% in a few years' time. However, 25% is still lower than your ordinary income tax rates. And also, within a limited company structure, you can offset expenses, all expenses in relation to that property within that entity, which you can't necessarily do if the property is in your personal name. So we support clients and in transferring personal properties and ending up in limited companies, or they start purchasing in the names of their limited companies. It's one of the things that we do. Another thing is creating, it's a bit of a buzzword, private client lawyers love family investment companies, but all a family investment company is a limited liability company registered with Companies House. Now, there can be limited companies, there can be unlimited companies. For property portfolio owners, we don't recommend that it's an unlimited company and you do have limited liability. Now, family investment companies are an excellent way to start adding the next generation into the business. Without them necessarily being involved in the business, but for tax efficiency reasons to start bringing them on board. So I'm dealing with one at the moment that the company is worth £1 million. And we know that, the growth trajectory of that company for this couple in their 50s, it's worth £1 million today, but we can bet our bottom dollar that in 10 years' time, there's some decent properties in there that's going to be worth at least £5 million. Okay. Now, maybe a bit longer than 10 years, but say it's worth £1 million today, in 10 years, it's worth £5 million. Now, if that couple pass away in their 60s, 70s, and that company is worth £5 million, then that full £5 million of a rental property portfolio is subject to inheritance tax. Now, we can carve out what's called growth shares and involve other members of the family within that corporate structure, but without giving them any control. So they're not allowed to become directors, they're not allowed to have a vote in relation to what happens in the company, but they can have the growth of the company. So when an individual does pass away, then the entire company is not subject to inheritance tax. Now, it's important to get the timings right in relation to structures like that. And again, it's very much dependent on where an individual's trajectory is, what the current ages are, what the current health conditions are. So we look at everyone and give them bespoke, tailored advice in relation to their individual circumstances. Okay, and I can't see a few questions coming up, and we will answer your questions, we promise, but I'll just make this final point, and then hopefully, Tom, if you don't mind reading those questions out, then we're more than happy to answer them. So the final point is the use of lifetime trusts. So Lucy gave us an excellent summary of planning that we do after death in relation to incorporating trusts within wills after death. But there's lots of trusts that we can use in our lifetimes to take advantage of certain tax breaks for property owners. And whether they are investment property owners or whether they are trading property owners, that we can utilize trusts. Now, certain trusts in certain circumstances are a massive no-no, because trusts can sometimes have punitive charges higher than an individual have. But under other circumstances, they are just perfect for certain situations. And for example, an older client who really wanted to give away a property that they owned, the property was worth £500,000, but when they bought it, it was worth £100,000. Now, on their death, we knew that £500,000 property was going to be subject to 40% tax. They transferred it into a discretionary trust. They're able to apply for what's called holdover relief, not pay any capital gains tax, and pass that property on to the next generation free of inheritance tax as long as they survive 7 years. Or we can get insurance policies to cover them for that 7 years. There is a slight catch in that the discretionary trust, the ultimate beneficiaries, it then becomes theirs for capital gains tax purposes. But at the same time, it completely avoids that 40% tax that we were looking at avoiding, there was no other way of doing it other than that discretionary trust. It's very much bespoke on a case-by-case basis that we would discuss each individual's personal circumstances and take it from there. So that's kind of a whistle-stop tour from our perspective, and I will hand back to Lucy.
Thanks, Taz. So yes, I think that's everything, and there are details there if you do want to get in touch. As we said, we do offer a no-obligation free consultation, and I think there might be some questions if I just end this show here and just go back to yourself, Tom, to feed through some questions, if that's okay.
Thank you very much indeed. More than happy to jump in here. In fact, to be honest, this is the only thing I do. So I'd be disappointed if I wasn't able to do this. That you would negate the point of me being here. So I'm delighted to take the reins. Thank you both very much indeed. Very useful stuff. I've got a few questions. I'll absolutely jump on some questions from the chat. Yogesh is, in his usual fashion, coming in with some great ones. So people are going to have to jump in there quick to do better than that. Before we get onto bear trusts, because that's what mostly excites me, I'm excited to know what those are. But on a few more perhaps basic questions first. What's a private client department? Or more accurately, I realise you both work there, so hopefully you've got a good idea. But what's the alternative? A public client department? A company client department?
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, so private clients is just private individuals as opposed to companies, but saying that we do advise companies as well, so I suppose it's not that correct in what we say, but yeah, it's basically to cover anything, private taxes, or as we said, the wills, the powers of attorney kind of points. Yeah, so we cover anything really for an individual, whether it's them themselves personally or for their company.
Okay, so a lot of it says private clients, it also covers, as long as it's people, it's also their company, so it's business stuff as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hence you covering some of that in your case studies there. The you deal with this every day, so hence this question. The scariest part about all, there's lots of taxes is essentially what we're dealing with, and making sure we deal with that in an efficient way, and making sure that we try and reduce those, the tax payments to obviously the minimum legal required. Having heard a few amazing people like yourselves speak on this topic, the thing that comes through to me again and again, and personal experience, friends and family and things, I've got to please to say it's not affected me yet, but it has affected people near and dear, is the scariest part of all this seems to be, I guess maybe it depends on the situation, but generally speaking, typically speaking, seems to be the care taxes rather than the inheritance tax. I mean, inheritance tax clearly is scary if you've got an estate of 1 million plus, certainly 2, 3, 4 million, then 40% of most of that is pretty terrifying. But it seems like the way I think about it is that's 40% of your stuff, whereas care taxes can take you down every single last bean that you've got down to, I think, is it 20 something thousand, which seems a lot more scary. Am I oversimplifying, or is that your experience too?
Yeah, absolutely. And we tend to say that there can be two types of clients, and they can be those who have the inheritance tax problem and they want to protect an estate from inheritance tax. But then at the same time, we also advise clients who may not have an inheritance tax problem, but just want to protect their estate from care home fee planning. So, for instance, your married couple who may have a property worth £200,000 and some cash in the bank, £30,000 in an ISA. Those are the type of clients who come to us who don't have an inheritance tax problem, but what they are concerned about is care home fee planning for the future. And again, more than happy to sit down with those clients. And again, it comes down to trust and putting in place mechanisms to try and protect an estate for future generations, whether that is from the inheritance tax point of view or from a care home fee point of view.
Okay, excellent. Speaking of trust, you mentioned on one of the slides that they can be complex. I imagine they can be as complex as the person's situation now, or as simple as the person's situation if it's just fairly straightforward. But with that in mind, I don't yet have trust set up, maybe something I'll look at in the future. Are they something, you know, like your taxes that you've got to look at? Clearly, you can't just set and forget completely. And you talked about letter of wish as a way of sort of looking to vary things and without having to go back and do expensive paperwork. But I suppose my rather convoluted question is this, if I set up a trust, am I then looking at spending hundreds or thousands of pounds every year to sort of keep that up to date, or can it be simpler than that?
No, that's what the beauty of a trust is over a basic will. So the problem with a basic will, it's very specific and you have to make the main amendments as time changes every 5 to 10 years. The good thing about a trust will is the actual terms of the trust itself within the will often don't need to be changed, amended. What the draft is flexible trust, so as flexible as possible. And then what you have then is the letter of wishes, which dictates to your trustees how you wish for things to happen when you're no longer here. And it's the letter of wishes that you update as time goes on. And that's why it may be more expensive up front for a trust will, but in the long term, you're not spending the same amount of money updating a basic will every 5 to 10 years. All you need to do is, and the letter of wish is going to be a Microsoft Word document, you're just updating the Microsoft Word in layman's terms and signing it and providing us with a copy. So over time, they're more cost effective and an easier way of making amendments.
Okay, excellent. If I've got, let's imagine I've got 10 single let properties, which I think probably is a typical portfolio size for this group. I'm sure there's some people on here with no properties and some people with 1,000, but let's go for a typical portfolio size of, say, 10 single let properties. How much am I looking at to set up a trust? I realise that'll depend on my situation, but am I looking at £100, £1,000, £10,000? What am I?
So roughly, again, it varies on the type of trust you want to do, whether you're putting one or two trusts in place, but you're probably looking around probably the 1500 mark.
Okay.
Is roughly where you're at. Obviously they go up from there and they go down from there, but if we, you know, roughly.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's not nothing, but it's a lot better than paying 40% inheritance tax or every last bean
exactly.
I've got. Care, isn't
exactly.
It? Yeah. Okay, and you mentioned business, and that was a new one to me. Well, business isn't new to me, but what is new to me is the idea that there might be a different kind of, I realize there's lots of different kinds of trust, but there might be a very specifically different kind of trust if, for example, you own 10 single lets in your single name versus I'm actually mostly penniless or just get by, but I've got a business with 10 properties in it and I might have to deal with those in a slightly different way or different kinds of trust. Have I got that right?
Yeah, so you have what's known as a business property relief trust. Now, therefore, trading businesses. So obviously there's a difference between a business developer who runs a trading business, who buys and sells land, and then a business investor, so someone who just invests in a business. Mm. And the inheritance tax rules around those, and a business developer trading tends to be more effective from inheritance tax purposes. Now, if you do have a trading business and you have business shares that qualify for this business property relief, then that's the type of will trust we put in place. And there's a planning that can be done around that.
Okay, excellent. And lastly for me for the moment, then we'll jump on some questions from the chat. What's a bear trust sounded exciting for those on the podcast. That's B-A-R-E. What goes on there? I picture a lot of outdoor dancing and things, but I'm guessing maybe that's not the case.
Yeah, it sounds more exciting than it actually is. So yeah, so a bear trust is simply holding, for instance, a property. For the benefit of someone else. So for instance, if you own the legal title, but the actual beneficial title is for somebody else, maybe a child or another owner, that's what a bear trust is. And for all intents and purposes, the beneficiary owns the equitable title. It's theirs for tax purposes, for succession planning, but the legal title might be in someone else's name.
Okay, excellent. And with the bear trust, there was another one I forgot to make a note of. Was that a discretionary trust, or have I got that mixed up?
Yeah. So a discretionary trust is a different type of trust. So it's not like a bear trust. So with a discretionary trust, you have trustees, and then you have a class of beneficiaries. And it's at the discretion of the trustees what the capital and income the beneficiaries receive. So while with a bear trust in comparison, it's always the beneficiary's owners for tax purposes, for all intents and purposes. The discretionary trust, by its very name, is discretionary.
And then I saw that was my last question. I was lying. I was reading the other day that 20% of women by the time they get to 40 in this country have chosen not to have any children. There are lots of other stats around it, but that was one I was reading. So that means that we've got an increasing number of childless people, families, of which I'm one so far anyway. So what do you find that people tend to leave, if whether they're setting up through a trust or just a simple will or however they do it, when people passing on, how do you find that people who don't have any children are leaving their stuff to? Is it cats and dogs homes? Is it obviously like a family sort of children, your nieces and nephews, things like that?
So people tend to do percentages, so they don't need to leave it 100% to one person. They can split their estate percentage wise, and that can either be to siblings or to nephews and nieces. It could be to charities, so that's quite popular, and especially for an inheritance and tax purposes, leaving to charities is very helpful in that regard. It's personally down to the individual and what and where they want to leave it to. But yeah, either family members or charities, or yeah, as you say, dog homes, donkey sanctuary is quite a popular one.
It's not every week we get mentions of donkey sanctuaries. I think it's good we've got that in. We need to get that in more. Could become a bit of a thing for us. All right, let's crack on with much better questions from the people here. So Yogesh asks a question. Letter of wishes. Do trustees, executors legally have to follow the letter of wishes? I'm guessing not, given the word wishes.
No. Legal letters of wishes aren't binding. And then that's why it's very important to appoint trustees who you trust implicitly, because they, you are putting your estate in their hands. Mm. They are normally followed, but then it's not legally binding. It is just an expression of a wish. And you should really ensure that whoever you appoint, you hope will follow those wishes, or at least act in the best interests of the beneficiaries. And trustees are bound under laws to do so.
Yeah, you put in your letter of wishes, you want all the money to go to a donkey sanctuary. Suddenly they're giving all the money to Ibex. What's the point in that? So you've got to be careful. Ibex have got enough help already. It's the last thing we need, more bloody Ibex.
Can I ask something on that, if you wouldn't mind?
On Ibex, go for it.
So I have a family member who was given that executive's responsibility, and did nothing and didn't share it out at all. And I assume has kept everything, including the stocks, the shares, the house and everything else that came with it. Recourse do you have?
You can't do that. And that's when legal action should really be taken place. So trustees are bound by the Trustee Act. It is a legal duty that you take on. You should follow the letter of wishes. If you don't do so, you should have reasons and plausible reasons of why that is you're not following those letter of wishes. You can't just go off on your own back and distribute money at left, right and centre as you want to do. You've got to act in the best interest of the beneficiaries. If somebody is doing that, then you do have legal recourse against them. So when we see all the time contentious probate cases where you can take a trustee to court because they're not acting rightly for the beneficiaries. So it's not legally binding, the letter of wishes, but it doesn't mean trustees can do what they want.
Thank you very much. Excellent question. If someone's riding around on your Ibex, you take them to court and you sort it out. You don't stand for that sort of thing. Thank you very much. Question. The trusts once created, how do you open a bank account for the trust that is formed? Does the bank just need to see the will to open it?
It depends on the assets. You'll either need to see the will or there maybe need to be a grant of probate. But yeah, you would go and speak to a bank, or we have banks that we use and they open what's known as a trustee account, which is just like your normal bank account that we have, but it's actually in the names of the trustees. And then they manage those funds then and invest it appropriately for the benefit of the trust and the beneficiaries.
Okay, and Yogesh also asks, what are the pros and cons of unlimited and limited companies? I love the idea of an unlimited company. Sounds a bit like Amazon.
Taz, do you want to jump in about the company limited and unlimited section?
Sure. So an unlimited company, actually, let me start with a limited company. So a limited company has a limited liability. So if the debts exceed the assets, then there's no recourse on you personally if the company goes bump. With an unlimited company, there is, if the company goes bump, then they come after you personally. The reason why some of our ultra high net worth individuals choose an unlimited company is because they put assets within that structure where they're highly unlikely to go bump, and because they are ultra high net worth individuals and they get anonymity. So with a limited liability company, you have to register it at Companies House. You've got reporting requirements. With an unlimited company, there aren't the onerous reporting requirements, so you can have anonymity. That's the main difference between the two.
Wow, didn't know that. Some anonymity goodness. I'm all about that. Excellent stuff, thank you. I'll sort of scooch around the questions a bit. I like Kathy's question, which is owning, you can try and unpick this one. Owning property as tenants in common rather than joint tenancy can also help to achieve this, I believe. Interesting use of pronouns, because I've got no idea what this she's referring to. But.
Yeah, I think she means, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think she means care home fee planning. So owning a property as tenants in common rather than joint tenants can achieve this.
Okay.
Yes, can, but also with the wills. So if you own a property as joint tenants, it means that if husband was to die, it would automatically pass to wife, irrespective of what the will says. If you own a property as tenants in common, what that means is you own a 50-50 share of the property each. When one of you passes away, that half then passes in accordance to the will. And then it's then in that will, if you have that trust structure, that half share is protected, and the other half is still the individuals for them to use and potentially if they're going to care. But yeah, tenants in common and joint tenancy, if you have a tenants in common over joint tenancy, that can come into play for care home fee planning as well.
So can you just clarify, that's actually in conjunction with the will then?
Yeah, so you do it in conjunction with the will. So you would ensure that you would always change. When we do flexible life interest wills, you would always change the tenancy from joint to tenants in common. And then that half share then passes in accordance to the will into the family, into the trust that we've created, and protects it.
Thank you.
No problem.
Excellent. And lastly, just for as we're running short of time, let's get Isu's question out there, which is, if you transfer privately owned house to a limited company or a trust, are there any issues with capital gains? For example, you sell it to a company at cost price or market price.
So if at the moment of transferring a privately held home, there is no capital gains tax at the time that you transfer it. Just need to be mindful of the tax consequences ongoing. So if I transfer my home, which is worth £400,000, into a limited company, and I bought it for £300,000, at the point of transfer, there is no capital gains tax issues. But going forward, the company then acquires it at £400,000, and then the company is liable for corporation tax on the growth going forward. So I'm usually adverse to planning around the family home, because the family home is the most tax efficient asset you're going to own. There's usually no capital gains tax in the family home. There's usually additional inheritance tax relief if you've got a child on the family home, so that, and you don't have to pay the higher rates of stamp duty on a family home. So it's the last thing that I touch when I'm looking at property portfolios.
So just to be clear then, in that example, nice house, by the way, that's worth £400,000. So if the company buys the home from the people, the family, whatever, for £400,000, and it was originally bought by the family at £300,000, there's no capital gains tax to pay at that point. The problem is then when the company a few years later sells it for £500,000, they've got to pay capital gains on the uplift between £400,000 and £500,000, namely the £100,000 uplift. Is that right?
That's right, but it's not capital gains, it's corporation tax, because it's within.
Right, of course, yeah. Yeah.
But there is a taxes to pay.
Yeah, I'm going to say either way, the money's gone out of your account. But yes, I of course, good to get the labels right. Smashing. Thank you all very much for attending, and for those of you listening to the podcast, a special thanks, of course, to our speakers, Lucy Fowler, and our bonus speaker, Tasmin Khalid, probably our first ever bonus speaker. So I've enjoyed that, and I hope you have too. Tune in next week when don't tune in next week, because we're all going over to, I'm going to be hosting the very exciting Asana Connected. I've forgotten the right name for the event, Howard. You're going to have to fill me in. What's it called?
We're calling it the Wealth and Property Summit.
The Wealth and Property Summit, and a good name it is too. I'll be hosting that, so join us over there, and I'll be posting in the cover group in the week for those who want to come along, free of charge.